Good evening. Welcome to the Salieri Report. Today is Thursday, July 12th. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm delighted you could join me this evening for the second quarter 2018 wrap-up, the equity overview, and Rambus Chartology. If you haven't checked out the web presentation for the second quarter 2018 wrap-up, take a look at the charts that we have for the close of the second quarter. You can see the full year in those charts. It's a great roundup. And then Rambus's blockbuster Chartology, which he finished up early this week. And another very insightful analysis from Rambus, and I'm deeply appreciative for his support in making these available to our subscribers. As you know, I think Rambus is absolutely the best natural technical analyst I've ever worked with, and so it's a real pleasure to have his materials as a resource. Let me talk a little bit about what the charts say. I'm not going to walk you through them. You can skim through them at your leisure. The stock market has been consolidating this year after reaching quite a high at the beginning of the year. The markets, I remember way back when in 2011 thinking, oh, can it possibly hit 1300? Well, you know, the S&P is over 2700. So it's been quite a run. Rambus at one point calls it the most hated bull market in history. The U.S. market is now up for the year. It's overperforming the other markets. Many of the global markets are down. In part, this is thanks to Trump's trade wars. And, of course, the problem being that if it gets worse and gets out of hand, everybody's going to suffer. If you look at the market, it's remarkable how little is strong. There are a few sectors that are really carrying the whole market, tech being the leader, but energy as well, pharma, consumer discretionary, defense. Real estate is finally coming back and is in the black, U.S. real estate. Let's just look as of the current close, the July 11th close. So consumer discretionary is up almost 14%. Crude oil up 16.36%. That's the ETN. Aerospace up 4.04%. Real estate ETF up 2.25%. The home builder is down 8.42%. But the overall S&P up 4.63%. And it's amazing the incredible financial steroids it's taken to accomplish that. China and Europe down, so the China large cap ETF down 7.46%. And their small cap down, it's doing better, down 3.41%. India down 5%. Now let's just take a look at Europe. Germany down 6%, and the European VGK ETF down 2.23%. So again, U.S. outperforming both the emerging markets and Europe. If we look at fixed income, it's come back a little, a tad, but it still reflects the higher interest rates. Again, the Fed following the market higher. The seven intermediate ETF, Treasury ETF, is now down almost 2% for the year, and the long Treasury down almost two and a quarter for the year, but an improvement over where it's been. It's come back a little bit. The predictions from many that we would see explosively higher interest rates is not coming true. There are a variety of different forces, both demographics and aging populations, both here and in Asia and Europe, sort of around the whole northern hemisphere, which are very deflationary, and clearly technology and information technology is very deflationary. So let's just look at some of the key points Rambus made in his analysis, which I think are very important. One of the things I love about Rambus is he always steps back and looks at the long run and really helps you get perspective away from the noise. The first point he makes is that the U.S. dollar is still in a long-term bull market. I absolutely agree with that. if anything, the trade war so far is happening to support the U.S. dollar and stock market overperformance. The danger, of course, is you get into the bear trap, a U.S. dollar bear trap in the emerging markets. We've lent massive amounts of dollars globally, and China and the emerging markets have really levered up with dollar borrowings. And now that it's Trump and the markets are making it harder to get those dollars, you could run into serious liquidity problems. And those liquidity problems could turn into a problem for everyone. So that's, if there's a risk on the environment I want to keep an eye on, it's that. As I said, Rambis notes, he puts up a chart of the industrials, the U.S. industrials, and calls it the most hated bull market in history. It's pretty funny, but he had a point that I want to stress. I think I'm going to read exactly what he wrote because I couldn't agree more, and I think it's very important and not sufficiently appreciated by many of the market commentators that subscribers tend to listen to. Quote, I would like to finish up this quarterly report by looking at four FANG stocks. FANG, of course, is Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. If our secular bull market is going to move higher, we'll have to have some strong legs under it to achieve much higher price objectives. As we've discussed previously, I believe the secular bull market has to do with new technology that is going to drive the secular bull market a lot higher over time. Areas like biotechnology, artificial intelligence, and robotics, just to name a few. And that's not just the companies that do that, but it's the companies that successfully apply those technologies to their core businesses. Anyway, as I've said before, I think the real fight with China is not over steel or any of the, you know, or soybeans or any of the things that the fight is occurring on. I think the real fight comes down to who's going to be the tech leader. And right now, the U.S. is very concerned that China could overtake it in the tech area. And when you look at the importance and the power of technology to the U.S. overperformance, it can't be stressed enough what power and sort of the superpower model comes down to is tech leadership, naval leadership, and space leadership. All three must-haves if you're going to continue to be the leader. And if you watch Trump, he's very concerned about all of those, and it has to do with the hiking of the military budget, some of his fisticuffs with technology and the tech leadership in Silicon Valley, and then clearly the announcement of the Space Force and Pence leading the sort of space group. It's also the reason why you're going to see continued immigration of people with high IQs into the United States. You know, there are really two immigration stories. I'm going to be talking about it more in 2 weeks when I talk about the rise of the Asian consumer. But the reality is the problem, if you bring capital and manufacturing and other capabilities back to the U.S., there's not going to be a labor constraint because you're going to immigrate the people you need in the sophisticated areas if you don't have them here. Rambis, after he did this report for us, also he started on a subsequent review of the bond market. And one of the things he's pointed out is signs of deflation that there shouldn't be explosive higher interest rates or what the chart's saying. And I would note this week a comment from David Stockman, which I tweeted out, 22 countries with negative two-year real yields. Good thing central bankers know what they are doing. What he does is he takes, it's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, approximately 16 that have negative yields. But then he looks at their CPIs and points out their real yields are, you know, are negative. And it's very, very significant. In fact, if you look at what he has for the CPI, he's using government CPIs. I think the real CPI is higher. So, it's probably worse than he's suggesting. There's no doubt that the squeeze, the harvesting of labor and certain fixed income, particularly in the intermediate long area, is one of the greatest sources of subsidy keeping this game going. If you haven't gone and looked at the Chapwood Index, I would strongly recommend you do it. I have recommended it a couple times. I'm trying to get the guy who prepares it to come on the Salieri Report. But it's a website that tracks the top ingredients into household budgets. And if you look at their analysis of what those numbers have been for the last 5 years and price increases for the last 5 years, inflation in the United States is running from 8% in the low inflation areas to 13.5% out in Silicon Valley. And that absolutely fits with what I'm watching. It's very interesting. In the newspaper this morning, I'm in Bucharest. I think the Romanian government is more honest than ours. They said that inflation was running at 5%. And here's what's interesting. Food prices are rising at 3.8%. Non-food prices are rising at over 7%. I suspect energy is part of that. And labor and services is, or they said services, but I would assume it means labor, is rising at 2%, which basically means, you know, you're financing the game by squeezing labor. And it's another reason that I don't think inflation will explode and bring significantly higher interest rates, although I do think rates have further up to go. Anyway, where does this leave gold? Rambis shows why the charts say it's uncertain. He basically says it could go up or down. You know, it's sort of, we're at an inflection point, and so it's uncertain. I'm not as bullish. I think gold will not be strong. We have too much strength in the U.S. and the U.S. dollar from tax reform, repatriation of capital, and new technology. And so the odds are very good that most people will feel the system is working, and that's not going to be good for gold, certainly in the shorter intermediate term. Now, it's interesting. I'm in Bucharest with Jason Bond-Smith, who sent me a great analysis or sort of walked me through a great analysis of what the obstacles are to continued U.S. overperformance. And I'd like to address those because, unfortunately, I think the U.S.'s ability to deliver steroids into the equity markets is much greater than other people think. And I wish I was wrong and they were right, but let me walk through it. First of all, rising interest rates. Rising interest rates are not going to be a problem for the major corporations. Traditionally, the stock market can digest 100 to 150 basis points a year with no problem. Right now, I think we're running at about 100 basis points rise a year. Now, this is particularly the case when government is as friendly to supporting with contracts and regulations. I talked in the last equity overview about the fact that Jeremy Grantham had thrown in the towel and recognized the fact that we have a combination of a Congress and political establishment combined with a corporate establishment that's basically overly friendly. And instead of having free market, we have a situation where, if not monopolies, we have significant oligarchy of a kind. And unfortunately, that game is crowding out free market players and squeezing the free market players. It's one of the things that, one of the reasons productivity is not increasing. But the reality is it means that corporations can deal with a fair amount of leverage and managing rising interest rates. It won't make a big cut in their profits. So rising interest rates, not a major problem for the game, so long as the corporations have income, which I'm going to get to because it underscores my fear of prioritization. The second thing is supply constraints. When you bring back this much capital, when you reduce taxes, encouraging significant investment, not to mention if you're bringing back the financial coup money, you run into real supply constraints of land, of inventory, of labor. And the reality is, I think that most market commentators don't understand the extent to which superhuman efforts can be used to deal with supply constraints. You need a couple 100,000 acres to expand Silicon Valley, no problem. You have the Santa Rosa fires. You need a high IQ workforce, you know, significant people all of a sudden back in the United States, no problem. You simply bring in significant people, immigration from Asia, educated immigrants. It was interesting. I said when I was out in Silicon Valley 2 months ago, or was it just a month ago? It seems much longer. But when I was out in San Francisco a month ago, there was no doubt. It certainly, everywhere I went, it looked like to me the Chinese and Asian population had increased about 10 to 15%. Don't be surprised to see, as we swing back operations, if we see significant immigration. Another constraint might be real resistance on the part of American leadership to play this game. It doesn't seem to be. There is extraordinary, if you watch the issuance of options to corporate leadership and then the stock repurchases, more than a few people have noted the fact that it's really criminal to the extent to which equity is being drained off by a combination of companies borrowing money to buy back stock, which is driving the options of the insiders and the value of the options up. You would think the pension funds would say something, particularly given how underfunded they are, but that's not happening. Anyway, one of the big swing questions in all of this is how much of the missing money is available for reinvestment or the money on the bailout. So if you look at the financial coup money, potentially there's an extraordinary amount of money to be reinvested, depending on where it went. You could argue that it's already been invested elsewhere, and so it's not available. But it's a big swing question, and if some is available, it's going to be far more than the repatriation of corporate cash. Now, the other question is, where's the real income going to come from? With productivity not rising the economy, where are all these companies going to get their profits from? And that's why one of the reasons why I'm so worried about prioritization. Another is, if you look at the early indications from the Trump administration and the latest White House reengineering proposal, they're clearly working their way up to major privatization. And I think the indications they've given us in the stated documents, like the White House reengineering proposal, are the tip of the iceberg. Now, so I think it's very important when you look at the equity markets and you assume, okay, well, the bull market is long in the tooth and it's going to go away. Don't underestimate the ability of the system to deliver steroids, whether it's the financial coup proceeds or the ability to basically hold up corporate profits with privatization. Now, I want to revisit the fundamental model of what's going on. For those of you who haven't read my online book, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, I strongly suggest it because it was designed as a case study to help you understand the basic model. And the basic model goes something like this. And this is a tornado that's been working its way through our economy for the last 20 or 30 years, particularly since the early 90s when the WTO went into effect. And that is, the politicians do something that caused stock prices to go up, or company profits to go up, or company PEs to go up, or both. So whether they pass a rule or they issue a new contract, the company's profits or their PE goes up, and therefore their stock goes up. That creates capital gains for investors. The capital gains take a portion of those gains and kick them back to politicians as political contributions. The number one source of political contributions is capital gains on both stocks and real estate. And around you go. And so we're watching Washington and Wall Street in a dance where Washington basically engineers the rules and engineers the contracts and engineers the purchases and engineers more and more. You know, we have a giant sucking sound of more and more the economy working through the federal budget in a way that props up the stock market. And again, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits was designed to be a case study to help you understand how it works. And part of the problem is it makes the economy weaker because productivity is lower than it would be otherwise if you had a free market process instead of a centrally controlled engineered process. And competition over time dies. That's why I thought it was so relevant that Jeremy Grantham finally threw in the towel and admitted that much of this was being, and a higher stock market was being engineered and pumped up through Washington. Needless to say, if that process, you know, causes the stock market to be held up with steroids, the quantitative easing that came following the bailouts and as part of the bailouts was, you know, one of the most massive deliveries of steroids we could ever possibly imagine. Actually, it was greater than anything I could imagine. And again, what this has done is this has left us with essentially a privileged class, which is happy to execute all of this for extraordinary compensation. If you look at our executive pay to labor ratio, it's significantly higher than other countries. And the reality is, you know, it's also supplemented by prison labor, read AKA slave labor. Anyway, the massive quantitative easing is over, and one of the potential supply constraints is that the Fed is reversing that quantitative easing by trying to work down their balance sheet and slightly raise interest rates. But here comes Donald Trump with massive fiscal stimulus in the form of military budgets and tax cuts. That's not enough, again, because how are we going to get income? Well, I think it's going to be prioritization. Let me give you a couple of things you need to understand. One is that there is an extraordinary opportunity in terms of reengineering government that has never been taken advantage of. When we have watched corporations re-engineer aggressively in the United States, more aggressive than in fact, in Europe. It's one of the reasons Europe's quality of life is higher. But extraordinary re-engineering of corporations to reflect the integration of new technology and downsizing employment and increasing corporate productivity. I think the impact on wider productivity has dropped dramatically as a result of this sort of vicious cycle with government subsidizing a lot of corporate profits. But there is an extraordinary opportunity to re-engineer government. Government employment over the last 30 or 40 years is, if anything, it's rising. And it doesn't need to be. We have massive amounts of layers of government. So why do we need to send a dollar to Washington and then have it come back in a very paperful state and local process? I think I've told you many times about the fact that when I became Assistant Secretary of Housing, and that was in 1989, 70 cents, I did an analysis of the programs that I had authority for at that time. And 30 cents on the dollar went into the local community. 70 cents went to a whole layer of federal, state, and local intermediaries. My analysis showed that when those programs had started, 70 cents on the dollar went into the local community. Now, with technology, it should have risen. It should have gone from 70 to 80 to 90. Instead, it had gone the other way. It had gone to 30%. And that's the cost of a negative return on investment on government money being used to prop up employment in a variety of ways, as well as prop up corporations. Now, if you and I were going to say, okay, well, let's truly re-engineer government, and let's truly privatize things that it does make sense to privatize. There are things that it does make sense to privatize. There are many more things that should be backsourced and insourced into government, like all of the payment mechanisms. There's a reason $21 trillion is missing, and that's because you have private corporations running the accounting and payment mechanisms, which is a serious breach of any sane internal financial controls. But if we were going to truly re-engineer government and make it productive and efficient and privatize that which makes sense to be privatized, there is an extraordinary opportunity to massively increase the productivity of government performance. If anything, that would take money away from corporations because, as I said, corporations are being massively subsidized. And then the reality for the rest of us is if we're going to dramatically improve productivity and in the government sector. How are we going to shift employment? And it brings us back to the question of not just reengineering government, but automation of many different sectors, because we're going into a period of accelerating change brought about by automation. I think I saw one number that said 4 million people supported themselves in the United States by driving trucks and cars. And basically, the premise is in 5 to 10 years, all 4 million of those people will be out of work. What's interesting is if you look at the size of the opportunity, of the true opportunity, let's just presume for a second that what is actually going to happen is not the true opportunity, but basically the kind of piratization we've seen over the last 20 years. And if you look at all the different symptoms that Washington is in a state of fever over all the money coming back and the possibility of just the prioritization that's in the president's White House proposals, it's significant. So for one thing, he's proposing to privatize Freddie and Fannie. And so the whole housing market can be essentially, the federal piece of it can be flipped in very astonishing ways, particularly if they throw in some of the other housing GSEs and operations. So let's just assume it's going to be prioritization. The amount of money and mega deals is going to be absolutely extraordinary. And the problem is, once it gets going, if there's no one to stop it or oversee it, we're talking about the kind of fever and fraud we saw with the housing bubble. It could even be worse, because what you're then going to get is you're going to get a gutting of operations. So why do I think it's going to be as bad as all of that? One of the reasons is the disinformation is off the charts. I have never in the last 20 years seen the extent of the disinformation. And I absolutely calibrate the level of the disinformation to the extent of the need for stock market profits to come from privatization. So what I'm saying is, if you look at what it's going to take to continue the bull market between here and massive integration of new technology, what it's going to take is prioritization. And those forces are lining up to make that happen. And to get it to happen, they need to do a couple of things. The first thing they need to do is to gut the civil service. If you look at the president's proposal, one of the things it proposes to do is basically rip up the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, known as OPM. But we're watching unprecedented disinformation attacking the Office of Personnel Management. You had this group who came out with a big attack on quote-unquote the SES, which is the leadership within the civil service. Then they attacked me because I said they were wrong. In fact, I think what you need is to make the SES stronger and put them in charge of payment and accounting. If anything, you need to go the other way. And of course, then they came out and said I'd never been Assistant Secretary of Housing, which was kind of funny. But now we have, we just had Martin Armstrong last week come out with, or this week, sorry, with a new statement that the deep state was in fact the civil service and it all went bad after 99, which is of any of the lies I've ever seen on this topic, was about the worst one. The deep state goes back is far deeper and greater than the civil service. Civil service, or a portion of the civil service, is only a part of it and far from the most powerful part of it. If you read Prouty or David Talbot, you'll understand what the deep state is and why Martin Armstrong is telling not only lies but outrageous lies. I'll leave it to you to guess whether he's incompetent, gullible, just simply entertaining, or paid to be unethical, or a combination. Who knows? But in addition, we now have David Wilcox and Robert David Steele basically saying Trump has gotten the missing money back. It couldn't be more ridiculous. I've had a couple of great allies say, You know the missing money is back when A, B, C, D, E. But let me just tell you when you know the missing money is back. You know the missing money is back when the federal debt's retired. You know the missing money is back when the pensions are fully funded. And you know the missing money's back when you and your family have received $65,000 per person return of your capital. Otherwise, if you're hired with capital that's been repatriated or your house is purchased with capital repatriated, you're just being bought with the money that was stolen from you. That's not getting your money back. You just couldn't believe some of the things that they've said. Now we have a guy who's even worse, named David DeGraw, running around trying to claim that he's the leader of the missing money story. God knows where he's going to take it. I keep getting various people emailing me about shenanigans he's been a part of in the past. And then we have other people jumping in, Roger Stone, et cetera. So, and there's more. I'll talk about some of this in later Money and Markets. But the reality is that if you're going to do this kind of piratization, essentially what you're talking about is the people who led the financial coup coming in to kind of get the last round of assets that they couldn't basically steal out the back door. They've got to steal these out of the front door. And so the last thing they want you realizing is that they're basically buying a variety of different assets or situations or commanding certain situations with money that's been stolen from you. And so it's essential to try and reposition the missing money story. The last thing they want to do is to be held accountable to return that money. And the extent of the disinformation shows that they're truly afraid of it, which if we use the missing money story as leverage on the pension funds, they should be seriously afraid of it. That one of the new sort of spins, there are different spins that come up. One is that Trump got the money back. But the other thing is, oh, you know, the Pentagon's been seriously bad about accounting, but trillions aren't really missing. It's just, you know, it's a few billion. It's not real. Of course, I believe the Fed fireplace and the obvious reality of all the hardware flying around the planet. Anyway, but the disinformation is very, very significant, which tells me that this relationship between reengineering the government and keeping the stock market bull market going is very, very real, because normally you don't have this kind of fever in terms of people getting excited about the privatization combined with this level of disinformation, unless you're talking about the kind of movement of capital that we saw in the 90s. The last time we saw disinformation of this extent and professionalism in terms of who's really behind in financing and overseeing this, the last time we saw it was in the 90s when the housing bubble began and globalization began. Now, another phenomena that's part of this that I wanted to mention is the growing move of ESG, environmental, social, and governance, or responsible investing. The quote I put in the commentary was, the demand for environmental, social, and governance, or responsible investing, is growing at a rapid pace, with nearly $23 trillion of assets being professionally managed under responsible investment. As of 2016, an increase of 72% since 2012, responsible investing has gone mainstream, driven by two major global trends, the increasing material financial impacts of mismanaging ESG risks and the rising decision-making power of millennials with their strong desire for sustainable investing. This is from two analysts at Jeremy Grantham's firm GMO in a study they wrote in March 2018. Now, why do I bring this up? People are really angry about the corporate model. If you look at the extraordinary waste of the corporate model to date, both through the government subsidization process that I'm always talking about, or the environmental damage. Ionizing the atmosphere is pretty environmentally damaging. People are really furious. And so the question is, how do you make corporations look good? And there's no doubt that the millennial generation is willing to hold institutions individually accountable. I see a lot more willingness of the millennials to just shun or walk away. Sometimes it's misguided by the some pretty clever politicians, but the reality is I think it's sincere. So the establishment understands if they want to run the world through corporations, they're going to have to find a way to make corporations either be better or look better. It's a topic for another day, whether or not this is anything other than another whitewash. Now, but it is very serious. And one of the reasons I'm interested in it is I'm working on screens where we've launched them in my other company now. One is called Solari World and the other is a space screen. We haven't announced them publicly. We'll announce them probably this fall before the end of the year. But they're operational now. And one of the reasons I wanted to do it is I'm so sick of seeing what I would consider to be whitewash screens. Somebody needs to do a real screen, and I'm very interested in doing it. We wrote, if you're interested, a great 2016 third quarter wrap-up on screening for productive companies. Can you screen for productive companies? And I believe the answer is yes. So expect, you know, whether it's whitewash or real, expect ESG or responsible investing to grow. Now, what does this all mean to you? That's what it comes down to for me, because I want you, despite extraordinary and accelerating change, to have a free and inspired life. So what this means, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Americans, employment's going to be good in selected sectors. If you are in high tech or defense, there's going to be plenty of demand for engineers, space, there's going to be plenty of demand. So if you're in the right sectors, there's going to be plenty of demand. If you're in the wrong sector, it's going to be dreadful. So you need to make sure that your skills are relevant. There are going to be small business opportunities, but you're going to have to be very, very savvy, and you're going to have to be very high-skilled. So this is a time when you have to keep up with technology. Whether you like it or you love it or you hate it, you need to understand it. AI, blockchain, robotics, it's a high-tech environment and accelerating, and you need to know what tech is going to do to you. If you're a truck driver, then you need to understand you've got 3 to 5 more years, and then you need to take your skills and be prepared by that time to have something else to do. I think there will be plenty of opportunities, but we all have to have extraordinarily high learning metabolisms. In the equity markets, be prepared for a correction. Don't assume that the bull market in equities or the dollar is over. If I'm right, there's plenty more steroids that can be brought to bear on this. But I do think I keep saying it year after year, we're way overdue for a much bigger correction. So the way to protect yourself on the downside is to have a hedge strategy. Watch out for getting in the way of the supply constraints. I hate to say this, but if these guys need a couple 100,000 acres where you are, you know, your house could get burnt down. That's the way of the world. I got a message from somebody saying that someone had posted a comment on their website that a friend had had his house burned down in California. Apparently, the fire started, and lo and behold, the electricity in the fire hydrants for the water pumps mysteriously did not work. Is that true? I have no idea. But I think we are looking at a corporate establishment and an investment establishment that is simply going to apply the Nike provisions of just do it. And if they control, basically, if they can create natural disasters, if they can engage in weather warfare, they're going to do it, and not just in the third world, they're going to do it in the first world, in our world. So watch out for getting in the way of the supply constraints. Watch out for liquidity issues coming out of the emerging markets. If we do get a serious bear trap with liquidity issues in the emerging markets, if anything, there's going to be good opportunities, because remember, the long-term growth is still better in the emerging markets, and I think that's going to continue. They have less steroids. Their companies are a lot less pumped with steroids, ditto in Europe. I think the real risk is the swamp speed traps in war. I talk about white collar speed traps. I think the way the powers that be in the United States are going to deal with political opposition is we're going to create white collar speed traps from sea to shining sea, audits, regulatory compliance. I think I read a couple weeks ago, we had a wonderful subscriber who's an attorney write in and say, you know, the average American breaks three laws, you know, commits three felonies a day and doesn't even know it. So I'm very concerned about the white collar speed trap. We just saw, I posted this story this last week, a 20-year-old in Ohio whose girlfriend was 17. Apparently in Ohio, it's legal to someone is considered an adult for purposes of having an affair if they're over 16. So it was perfectly legal for this 20-year-old to have an affair with his girlfriend who was 17. They sexted each other pictures that they were taking nude, but apparently that's a federal offense because you have to be 18. And so our 20-year-old was indicted by the feds and is basically having to defend himself against a charge which could put him in jail for 30 years. So that's what I call a white-collar speed trap. Prioritization fever is underway. If you work in government, whether it's federal, state, or local, you need to assess what it will mean or do to you. It gets very granular very quickly as to what it will mean. So, for example, Trump is saying he's going to privatize Freddie and Fannie. He's going to privatize the post office. He's going to rip OPM in half. But you need to take a look at what that is going to mean if you work in government, because I think government is in for some significant changes, and then that includes governments that where there's a real tension between paying the pension funds and paying the current labor, and the solution will be significant downsizing or more prioritization. Pay down your debt. This is an environment where I don't think interest rates are going to be explosive, but at the same time, I think one of the best – it's going to be harder to get yield in your investments than or if you look at the cost of consumer debt, it's just very expensive vis-a-vis what you could do on investments. So generally you want to absolutely pay down your debt. And then finally, I continue to be long-term bullish on gold for all the reasons you know, the reasons the Chinese are hungry for it and the reasons the Russians are hungry for it and the reasons the central bank are buyers. But as an investment category this year, I don't expect it to even touch what technology, successful application of technology to real opportunity, real operations is going to do. And then finally, in fixed income is the bull market, I believe, is over, although Rambis is making a good case that it might not be, but I think the bull market is over, and you have to be very, very careful about where you are in that market. In 2008, during the financial crisis, we saw that market drop, you know, fixed income markets, long, intermediate long bonds drop as much as 50%. So you want to be very, very careful about quality, because the quality issues are much greater now. So you want to be very careful about quality. And for now, if anything, you want to float up with the short-term interest rates. You don't want to go long and watch your securities dropping or your bonds drop in value. So be cognizant that we're in a modestly rising interest rate environment, and you'd rather float up than get the higher rates by going long yet. And you want to really be concerned about quality. So that's what it means to you. There's a lot of change and a lot of opportunity, but it's also easy to get clocked. So you want to pay attention. And it's one of the reasons I constantly emphasize, keep your overhead down and feel free to invest in your own knowledge and your health. You're the best investment you could ever make. They can destroy your business with a white-collar speed trap, but they can't. I shouldn't say they can't destroy their mind, because they sure tried to destroy mine. And I'm aware of the tools they can use, but the reality is, if you can walk away with it in your mind, it's a great investment. So it's going to be a period of change. Watch for the piratization fever. I think if you haven't been a part of privatizations, I've done literally billions and billions of them, but if you haven't been a part, it's hard to understand how it can roll through economy like a financial tornado. There is no doubt to me that a major financial tornado is building. And I think many of the constraints on that tornado are easily blown by, and that's the message that the Santa Rosa fires unfortunately have had. So those are my comments on the equity overview and the performance of the markets in the first half of the year. My expectation is, if anything, given the trade wars and a variety of the uncertainties on the international scene, if anything, we'll see very choppy markets between here and the third quarter equity overview. What we will see is a lot of decisions made that will inform how Washington proceeds with some of the plans underway. And so I would expect when we speak next in October, it'll be very interesting to see what is unfolding in the world of Washington and piratizations and the piratization fever that I'm certainly seeing emanating and waving out of the DC Beltway area. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for joining me on the Solaria Report. Based what we're seeing in terms of piratization fever, I have to say again, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.